Welcome to Current Affairs. My name is Nathan Robinson. I'm the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. My guests today are Harvey Kay. He is Professor Emeritus of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, as well as the author of books, including The Fight for the Four Freedoms, Take Hold of Our History, and, I've forgotten the name of the Thomas Paine book. What's the name of the Thomas Paine book?
Thomas Paine and the Promise of America.
Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. There we go. Sorry. Right. Welcome back to Current Affairs. Oh, there we go. Alan is holding up the book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Welcome back to Current Affairs, Harvey Kay.
Thank you.
And I'm also here with Alan Minsky. Alan is the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. And together, Harvey and Alan have put together a 21st century economic bill of rights program that they have been elaborating it through in a series of articles at Common Dreams. They've got a three-part series where they explain what a 21st century economic bill of rights would look like, why we need it, and why it is the path back to power for progressives. So we're going to talk about their agenda today, but there's also news that this the 21st century economic bill of rights that they have devised is beginning to take off, and I was just told before the program that it has now been embraced officially by the Massachusetts Democratic Party, which is a good sign, because what I'd like to start talking about with you both is the fact that you have developed this proposal, as I understand it, in part because the Democratic Party needs an agenda that is compelling. And you are responding to the present weakness and unpopularity of the Democratic Party nationally. So perhaps before we get into your positive program, you could lay out what you think are some of the problems with the direction the Democratic Party is heading in now. The widespread consensus is that if things do not change, they're headed for likely catastrophe in the November midterms this year, 2022, and also possibly even greater catastrophe in 2024.
Well, I'll just start off with a little historical perspective, and then Alan can take over with the most current crisis. The one thing we have to recognize is that the Democratic Party, in the course of the 1970s, truly abandoned the vision and indeed the agenda that from the 1930s into the 1970s made the Democrats the majority party. Even if they lost elections, they remained the majority party, except for very brief moments in Congress. And the fact is that in the 70s, there was this, you know, sort of understood coalition that developed between the corporate elite, Republican conservatives, and the new force inside of the Democratic Party, which originates with Gary Hart, but becomes literally a presidential force with Jimmy Carter. There began this sort of class war on the democratic achievements of the 1930s through the 1960s, on workers' rights, on the rights of women that were finally secured all the more in the course of the 60s, and on the rights of voters. And that especially means to target African-Americans. And basically, led by Jimmy Carter, the Democrats turned their backs on the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt. And this has continued truly for at least 45 years, if you consider not merely the campaigns lost in the 70s, but also the presidencies of Bill Clinton, the first outright neoliberal presidential administration the Democrats offered. And then, of course, it continued even with someone everyone had great expectations of, Barack Obama. And we've seen, after all the hopes and aspirations of earlier in 2021, this kind of lethargy in the party. And that lethargy is a consequence of their, in many cases, beholding to the same corporate interests that they lined up with back in the 70s. And on top of that, the sort of the persistence, I'll hesitate to say resurgence, but I think we all counted our chickens much too fast when we imagined that neoliberalism was dead. So after all of these years, the question becomes, what does the Democratic Party stand for? And if you go out on any street and ask people to tell you what the Democratic Party stands for, they'll probably tell you, whether they vote Democratic or Republican, they'll tell you things that sound like Republican talking points. So we got together, and I'm going to leave it to Alan to take it from here. We got together and you know, decided it was time, if you like, to offer a reminder and a vision to go forward with that sort of not just echoes, but literally picks up the FDR tradition and dynamic.
Yeah. Alan, what would you say about why you think that the Democratic Party is headed for doom in November?
Well, Harvey and I are in the unfortunate position right now, and I'm not sure if this is unfortunate, especially for people who are involved in analyzing American politics from the left, as all three of us have probably been our entire adult lives, because there's a sense of fulfillment in getting your analysis right and watching the left go down in flames or the Democratic Party go down in flames. We're in the unfortunate position of publicly advocating for something and then watching all of the missteps of the Democrats confirm our analysis. Yeah. You know, even when you look at probably the greatest success that the Democrats will have right now, if you're going to look into a crystal ball, odds are one of the bigger successes, if not the biggest success, that the Democratic Party is poised to achieve in the 2022 midterms would be picking up the Pennsylvania Senate seat. And the candidate there, John Fetterman, for all of his foibles, is basically running closest to the platform that we're outlining of any of the prominent candidates. And even where you look at the successes in the primaries, you look at Summer Lee, you even look at Jamie McLeod Skinner out in Oregon, there were very distinctive economic messaging that was foregrounded in the way that they distinguished themselves from their opponents. You see other close progressive races which have failed where this has not been done as fully. And we obviously have a lot of primaries still to go. I want to take us back a little bit also into history, back to 2014-15. And, you know, PDA are, of course, great claim to fame in the current political environment, as we were the sole national organization to draft Bernie Sanders to run for president and to do so as a Democrat. If you look at Bernie's recounting of the history of 2013 through 2015, you'll see that PDA were the gadflies continuing pestering Bernie to run. He was calling on Elizabeth Warren to run, and we were adamant that he run as a Democrat. The 2016 election, I think what happened, there was a lag in terms of the response to the global economic crisis in American electoral politics because of the charismatic figure of Barack Obama. And so you really only had the fallout from the Great Recession appear on the electoral stage in the 2016 election, and you saw the neoliberal consensus explode. And on the right, you had the Trumpian Republicans. Trump was engaged in his own critique of classical neoliberal positions, especially around global trade. And then you had Bernie Sanders on the left. And I would argue that through to the present, we now have three political tendencies vying for power within our two-party system. And that we have on the right wing of American politics, the Trumpian reactionaries. Then we have in the middle, the neoliberal consensus, which runs from the Romney wing of the Republican Party through the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. And on the left, we now have the progressive Democrats, the inheritors of the two Sanders presidential runs. And I believe that if it was just done on ideology and the ideas for the social vision were presented to the American public, the group in the middle would get slaughtered right now. They have almost no compelling argument to make to the American public. But of course, we're in a situation where all of the institutional structures and organizational logic of American society is constructed around that neoliberal consensus, including the mainstream apparatus of the Democratic Party. So we are now in a situation where we feel the winning hand for not just the Democratic Party, but for progressives within the Democratic Party has to be economics. And yes, one of the reasons we got drawn into emphasizing this, and PDA got in, and I got involved in proposing this to Harvey, that we take it forward as a political platform, is because the progressive left is consistently represented in the mainstream media as being entirely about woke culture, about cancel culture, about issues other than economics. In fact, in our second of our three articles, by the way, we lay out the actual bills put forward by progressives in Congress that match up with the Economic Bill of Rights. And it's also to defend people who sometimes do probably overemphasize or get caught into Twitter storm arguments about, you know, this or that use of language. And then the right wing and the mainstream media sort of chides them for doing so. Their work in this Congress was largely focused on strengthening the economic measures of Build Back Better. And that was, of course, the central focus of the work of Congress, which, of course, itself turned into a complete catastrophe for the Democratic Party. But in that whole narrative, the progressives in Congress consistently were saying, OK, that's in Build Back Better. It should be this, or we have to keep it at this place. And all was about maintaining a left economic position within an economic program. That's the winning hand for the Democratic Party. And we have to get people to recognize that the way that the Democratic Party, let alone progressives, win elections is by adopting the progressive economic policies, just as they did in the 1930s. And from the 1930s to 1994, the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives 58 out of 62 years. Since 1994, the Gingrich Revolution, when Clinton already signaled his neoliberalism, the Democratic Party has held the House of Representatives 8 out of 28 years. I think that shows what a winning hand is for the Democratic Party.
There was a New York Times article a couple of days ago, headline, "Embattled Democrats Hope January 6th Hearings Will Motivate Voters." And the body of the article explains that in the House of Representatives, there are a number of Democrats who hope to what they call refocus the attention of voters on the riots of January 6th. They have these big televised hearings. It said they've hired a television executive to help produce the hearings and make what they call made-for-TV moments. But what's interesting about the article is that it acknowledges, they call it an uphill battle to get voters to focus on January 6th, because what they say is when you poll voters, all of their concerns are economic. Right. All of the things that voters say they care about have nothing to do. January 6th is very, very low on the list. So they have to. So they're undergoing this huge effort to try and make people be interested in the January 6th hearings. Now, I found January 6th to be quite a terrifying event. I thought it was like a kind of beer hall putsch event that you go, well, this looks ridiculous now, but it may be it'll be worse next time. However, I think we see here some of what you say, which is that in response to this recognized hunger from voters who are asked and then who they tell you quite plainly what they would be interested in seeing, Democrats, instead of responding to that by building out the kind of platform that you're describing, say, well, we're going to have to work very, very hard to make voters focus on the thing that we want them to focus on instead.
Yeah, you know, I saw that unfold, and I didn't, and I, you know, at the moment, it just seemed like, you know, how bad can it get? And it got as bad as one could imagine on that day. And one fully expected that those folks and those behind those folks and those above those folks would pay a price both personal and decidedly political. But what we've seen in the past year is that the battle lines just got, you know, more rigid and more rigid. So it's like a few weeks ago, I think they said, well, the threat to Roe v. Wade will mobilize women to vote for Democrats. Then now it's the January 6th hearings. Unfortunately for the Democrats, I can tell you that, you know, young people who generally don't turn out for midterm elections will probably not be motivated to vote in terms of the January 6th hearings. They will be motivated to be bored by them because they were assured that at least to some extent, the student debt relief would be forthcoming under a Biden administration. That's one example. It's striking to me how the Democrats live up to all the accusations of the left, that the Democrats have become the party in the pocket of the money power, as much as the Republicans. And I can tell you honestly that when Alan and I were working on this, we imagined we would help to empower progressive politics that itself might save the Democratic Party and thus have us avoid the debacle in November, and beyond that, the danger to democracy. And I'll just say that, it's hard to argue that the Democrats are willing to really embrace as the party leadership. Let me be clear. The Democratic Party leadership is willing to embrace these things. It remains the case that they politically and their corporate allies have really gone out of their way to back the folks who aren't just, you know, centrist Democrats, but in some cases, actually reactionary Democrats. The most recent example, of course, is that Pelosi herself, in the wake of the leak about Roe v. Wade, continued to endorse, and I understand made, you know, recorded robocalls for Henry Cuellar down in Texas against a very, a really outstanding candidate, Jessica Cisneros, who right now we haven't had the vote recount yet, but it's within striking distance of taking that seat. But it's the fact that the Democratic leadership backed her. And before that, we saw the Democratic leadership last summer and again this year do everything in their power to block a Nina Turner victory in Cleveland. So it's, you know, it's hard to get enthused by the Democrats. In essence, Alan and I would like to try to save them, but by way of progressive advances.
Well, and I think, look, the obviously informing everything Harvey just said and what I said about the three formations within the two-party system is we do see there is no evidence of the two-party system changing in terms of its domination, entire domination of American political electoral politics. And so we are operating inside a two-party system. And what, you know, what we're involved with in PDA from our founding in 2004, we have our roots back in the 1984, 1988 Jesse Jackson campaigns, the Kucinich campaign of 2004. Of course, at that time, foreign policy was one of, it was one of the rare moments, the sort of post 9/11 era where we're in Iraq war era, where economics were not the absolute dominant issue within American politics for the most part over the last five decades since the economic crisis beginning in the 1970s. If you look at public opinion polling, what is the top concern? Not only is economics, the economy, just lapping everything else. You look at second, third, fourth, fifth places, with a few exceptions like the pandemic, like the post 9/11 era with the Iraq war, you have basically economic concerns such as the cost of healthcare, the cost of housing that enter into, and the cost of education now enters into the equation, all of which, of course, are fundamentally economic concerns. And when you add up all the things that are fundamentally economic concerns, the idea that the progressive left sitting on a set of economic proposals that are compelling to the American public do not lead with this. I think there's, again, this goes into a lot of the questions about, you know, who sort of makes up the apparatus of the progressive left in the United States. I do think we have a problem where we have still a lot of people with a lot of internalized what could be called, and I know this is a cliched term a year or two on since it's become popular, like professional managerial class aspirations, as opposed to actually having grassroots working class communities really sort of grab hold of this as it was, I think they did when it was initially brought back onto the American electoral stage by Bernie Sanders in 2014, 15, and 16. And you really see, you saw throughout, especially the sort of long arc of the 2016 electoral cycle of Bernie Sanders making inroads in working class communities that you had not seen any other candidate do around an economic message, a unifying economic message. And I think, look, for we, of course, at PDA in no way waver on any of the other things that make up a broad left agenda. We support, of course, very much stronger gun rights legislation, fully support, obviously, a woman's right to choose. It's a top priority. Racial justice, you know, addressing the mass incarceration, the prison industrial complex, of course, racist policing. All of these matters need to be addressed by public policy. But the way that you get them addressed, just being realistic, I mean, forget pragmatism, just realism, is you have to win elections. And you win elections in this country by having an economic program, which we have. We have the popular economic program. Yeah. You look at issue by issue, poll by poll, we are the people who can make a case to the American public, this, who understands something has to change, that the general economic social contract is out of balance in this society. Okay? And we can make the case and we can make it very eloquently. But we're not, as a political formation. Bernie really did so. Some of the progressive champions do better than others, but it really is in the totality of the movement has to be foregrounded. Or let's face it, just sort of putting yourself on. You want to be a revolutionary, but you don't want a revolution, is what I would say to the people who sort of pose on the left and don't foreground economics. because that if you that's where the working class, that's where the precarious middle class, that's where the majority of the population are in their concerns. That's what we have to communicate with them about. And anything else is going to be just, we're just going to, you know, play into the hands. Well, no, we're not going to necessarily play into the hands. We're going to be defeated by the neoliberals with their avalanche of money. And by the way, they've shown they're scared of us because look at the money they have poured against us in this election cycle.
Sure.
That can't be lost in terms of some of these candidates not winning. It's been record shattering for primaries.
Although it's a little disturbing that the many leaders in the party seem to be so rigidly committed to this neoliberal ideology that they would rather lose elections than embrace progressive politics. I mean, Hillary Clinton probably could have been president if she'd considered putting Bernie Sanders on the ticket, but it just didn't cross her mind that she could even make him VP because she's found his politics so just so anathema that it had to be defeated. And you see the same thing going on right now, where as voters are clamoring for the kind of agenda that you lay out here. But the question is, how can we motivate them to care about something else? But what you do here is you say, well, okay, they might not change. you might not change Nancy Pelosi, and you might not fix the leaders of the party who really have made it clear that they are not going to embrace popular politics. But at the very least, what we on the progressive left need to make sure is done, is that we have a clear and intelligible story that is put together, that where when people ask, well, what do you stand for? If we are going to challenge the leadership, if we are going to challenge this consensus, we can explain it in some bullet points, and we know what it is that we're behind. So I want then to turn to what the program that you think is the winning program and why you've laid out the particular points that you have as the things that you think progressive Democrats need to rally behind.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned the key word story. And one of the things that FDR realized is that however seemingly desperate so many Americans were in the 1930s for a change, the question is, what kind of change would it be? And FDR was convinced that it was imperative to reach into the American story itself to frame what struck many people as radicalism, as socialism, as a drastic transformation. And in fact, it was a drastic transformation, but as he repeatedly said, these are rooted deeply in the American story. He went back to the Declaration of Independence to validate the New Deal and eventually even this economic Bill of Rights that he presents in 1944. And what we're saying is that this economic Bill of Rights that we're proposing is itself rooted in that fundamental American story. We go back specifically to the New Deal, to Franklin Roosevelt's 1944 State of the Union Address, where he told Americans, we've come to that point in American history where we realize that needy people are not free people. And he then proceeded to lay out the basics. Well, what a lot of people may not realize is that when he laid that out, he knew he could not accomplish it because of the coalition of Northern corporate Republicans and Southern, what came to be called the Dixiecrats, the white supremacist Southern Democrats. However, he wanted to speak to the American people and have them come to understand that these things were not only desirable, but indeed possible. And there remained this current through what, for lack of a better word, we can still call the progressive tradition. And in fact, in 1960, the Democratic Party platform that Kennedy ran on was laid out in terms of the economic Bill of Rights. In fact, those who drafted the platform were worried Kennedy might not be able to embrace it because he did his best to deny he was a liberal for so many years. Then in the mid-60s, both A. Philip Randolph, the Black labor and civil rights leader, and Martin Luther King Jr., not long before his the tragedy of his assassination, both advanced arguments. Randolph advanced a freedom budget in 1965 that was based on FDR's call for a vision of the four freedoms and his call for the economic Bill of Rights. And in 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. himself actually called for an economic bill of rights for all Americans. And as we know, Bernie Sanders, both in 2015, you know, in the year before the actual election, and in 2019, in both cases, laid out in speeches the imperative of Americans remembering FDR's economic bill of rights and doing our best to redeem them. So we're trying to remind Americans that this is not something out of Alan's head and my own head somehow, but actually is rooted in this American vision, this American project that for too long, not only have Republicans opposed, but as I was saying earlier about the 1970s, Democrats turned their back on. But Bernie has, in essence, provided an opportunity. Now, in the Economic Bill of Rights, Alan, you want to do those? Do you want to just go through those? Or
Sure. One thing is that we do have a web page on the PDA website, and it's very simple to get to, which is pdamerica.org. So pdamerica.org/Economic Bill of Rights, all one word. So pdamerica.org, Economic Bill of Rights. You'll see at the top the links to the Three Common Dreams article that Harvey and I have written. And below that, you'll see a list of the Economic Bill of Rights that we're proposing. And it simply says, a 21st century Economic Bill of Rights will guarantee all people residing in the United States the right to the essentials of a good life, regardless of their income, race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or country of origin. A 21st century Economic Bill of Rights will establish that all Americans are entitled to 1, a useful job that pays a living wage, 2, a voice in the workplace through a union and collective bargaining, 3, a comprehensive quality health care. And I want to say these are listed as rights, human rights. So when we say that, it's understood, universal, available health care for all people. So the number 4, complete cost-free public education and access to broadband internet. 5, decent, safe, affordable housing. Again, establishing housing as a human right. 6, a clean environment and a healthy planet. 7, a meaningful endowment of resources at birth and a secure retirement. 8, sound banking and financial services. 9, an equitable and economically fair justice system. 10, recreation and participation in civic and democratic life. And by recreation, I proposed to Harvey that we change that language going forward. We've made adjustments, and of course, we evolved the list a little bit already since we initially introduced it, that recreation is intended to suggest the right to paid vacation for everybody who works that living wage job. And so those are the 10 that we propose. I want to actually pick up on what Harvey said too, rooting it in American history, because now, of course, we have a paradox globally, which is, and let's even frame this in terms of something we've thought a little bit more about as Americans recently, which is foreign policy because of the Ukraine crisis. If you look out across the world and you ask what are the other wealthiest technological industrialized societies in the world, the answer is pretty clear. It's the countries that were our closest allies, right, during the Cold War, right? So it is Japan, South Korea, Australia, Canada, and notably Western Europe. If you look at those countries, the other, quote unquote, rich industrialized technological societies in the world, that they show that this is not a utopian vision that we're putting forward because, again, paradoxically, because to a large degree, many of those countries, I mean, not Canada, not Australia, but many of them actually had their constitutions rewritten by veterans of the Roosevelt administration and the Truman administration, and they set in place structures that were going to facilitate the growth of their social democratic economic structures. And every one of those countries, more or less, right, have all of these statutes available to the citizenry, such that when you look at, if you take away indices related to aggregate wealth, when you look at the economic social welfare of all of those countries, the United States, again, taking away aggregate wealth indices because of the incredible wealth divide in the country, the United States is basically at the bottom of every one of the indices. You look at health, education, you look at crime, drug addiction, Mass incarceration, all of the welfare indices across the society, the United States ranks at the bottom. And indeed, in terms of wealth inequality, we are way at the bottom among all of those countries in terms of what's called the Gini coefficient. So we have a case to make to the American public. Look at this. You'll have a better life. You'll be healthier. You'll be happier, right? You'll be more secure. You won't live a life of absolute precarity. Not that that doesn't exist as neoliberalism has chipped away at those, but still the evidence is clear from the economic and social statistics that life for the people in those societies is more secure, less precarious. And in terms of human welfare, people are better off.
But it seems like part of what you're saying is that we need to make it clear how the various things that progressives push for all fit together into one coherent vision. So there's this whole argument about student debt forgiveness, where they say, oh, well, is student debt forgiveness, does this disproportionately benefit the more well-off? And I think if you take student debt forgiveness in isolation and you have a big conversation about that as the sole issue that we're talking about now, and then next week we talk about a different issue, then it does become a problem to try and get people who didn't go to college or don't have student debt to think about, well, why are we talking about this? But you're saying, you know, we need to take the student debt forgiveness, we need to put it together into this package, this clear agenda that has this very, very intelligible overall message that unites all of its prescriptions, which is what we want to do is we want to give you the life that you are entitled to. And we want to make sure that you are not deprived of things that you are basically owed by the fact that you live in a wealthy country that could and should provide them to every person. And it seems like just as much as you're laying out a set of particular things that you think progressives ought to guarantee, you're also laying out a way in which we can talk generally about our vision so that people understand how everything fits together as one.
Yeah, you know, just to go back in history and then come forward again, when FDR proposed the Economic Bill of Rights that he did in 1944, he had the prior year invested resources in a national survey asking Americans what they wanted to pursue after World War II, when the war was over. And as I think I've said to you in other occasions, 85%, nearly 85% of Americans, 95% of Democrats, 75% of Republicans wanted national health care. But along with that, they wanted public education all the way through, as far as students' abilities could take them, to be tuition free. They wanted comfortable housing for all Americans. In their minds, this was altogether what they wanted. They wanted the America that for many years the labor movement had sought to create, known as the, you know, the American standard of living. They wanted that. Now, today, I don't know if we mentioned it earlier, but as we know, every one of the items in this Economic Bill of Rights garners the majority of Americans' support when asked in public opinion polls and surveys. Americans want these things. And it's not that they just want them. It's that they believe that it is a statement. And this is FDR, what he did, that you cannot have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness without these. Okay, so in some ways, we've put together what should be the message and the framework for this vision. But it's also the case that we're hoping this will speak directly to people's fundamental understandings of what it means to be an American. The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And all you have to do is ask anyone, what does life require? And they will tell you healthcare, housing, food on the table, et cetera, et cetera. Ask them what the pursuit of happiness requires. And they will tell you the wherewithal to advance, the sense that they are secure and they have opportunities. These kinds of rights together represent, if you like, the redemption of the original social contract. Whatever the founders might have thought it was, it's there in text. It remains the founding document. It's time that we match our founding document and our 21st century ideals.
And if I can just add to that, as Harvey just hit upon, as you were touching upon, Nathan, it is essential that this wraps things up in a way that provides people with a vision for a better society. And we think that this achieves that. And there are just so many ways that I think it speaks to a sense of life fulfillment and making possible for the average household a kind of life fulfillment that is just become very difficult in a society where people overwork, by the way, tremendously compared to other societies of similar wealth, and live in incredible precarity. You know, you even have things like Mark Fisher's writings. I mean, obviously he's not a particularly well-known person among the general public, but the way he talks about the explosion of creativity in the 1960s, in particular with music among the baby boomer generation as being basically predicated upon the wealth that generation was able to experience and the sense of freedom they had as education was expanded. And of course, you know, you look straight at the state I'm in, California, and Ronald Reagan and Ed Meese went straight at that. That was the last thing they wanted. It was one of the sort of anchors of the Reagan Revolution was to not allow that kind of freedom to be available to a young generation that they viewed as being at that point, you know, seduced by communism and so on. as made clear by the songwriters across England and America, who were becoming very wealthy with their songs and creativity. But however paradoxical that may seem in the rearview mirror of history, that was the perception. And so again, the opportunity to fulfill your sense of yourself is here. I mean, I don't think this is an individualistic type of philosophy that we're putting forward. It is social, but I do think it resonates for a society in which this kind of individualistic approach to life in American society has been so foregrounded. I think people feel incredibly constrained. And I think it goes towards, again, a kind of mix of the social and the individual and the possibilities of life. There's no other blueprint that's being presented that works or has anywhere near the promise, I think, of what we're presenting. And again, the evidence of it working is apparent by all those social indices from across the other countries in the world.
Yeah. And I want to go back to something you mentioned briefly earlier, which is the, I believe it's the second article that you wrote, which is co-authored with Michael Brennan, where you go through all of the rights in your proposed economic bill of rights. And what you show is that each one of them is embodied already in a piece or multiple pieces of proposed legislation that are in Congress right now that progressive legislators have put forth. And that therefore we are not just talking about an abstract wish list of great aspirations, but what we can do is we can connect this set of basic entitlements that together comprise the good life, and we can then connect those to specific measures that are not just put in place already in other countries, but that there is already legislation that we could pass that would get us closer to achieving each one of those 10 things. And so when you present this program to voters and they say, well, that all sounds very nice, you know, what are you going to do? You say, well, look, if you elect progressives on this platform, these are the bills that we can pass. And these are the things that this bill will do to advance number one. And this bill will do to advance number seven. And so it's both a very idealistic set of prescriptions, and it's got the storytelling aspect, but it's also very, very concrete in that it links up to things that progressive legislators who have names and their bills have names are proposing right now.
Well, I think, look, obviously one of the major aspects of the world right now is the climate emergency. And so we have the statute in there about a clean and healthy planet. But I do think the United States of America, with its assets and a need to reset basically its industrial policy, would probably be central to the fabric of a lot of the proposals, and it is central to the fabric of a lot of the proposals that we point to in that second article that we wrote with Mike Brennan. So obviously the Green New Deal sort of blends well with this, but in particular, the need to remake our energy systems, the kind of industrial capacity that would facilitate that, that would also insulate the United States from the vulnerabilities that were exposed over the last 2 years in terms of supply chain, and the necessity of doing this and getting us all off of fossil fuels. And in that respect, the United States and its assets in terms of its educational infrastructure, there's never been a society in the world that has the scientific technological research capacity of the American university system, which, by the way, I think is becoming frayed and fragmented under the pressures of neoliberalism. This is a social asset that is just unparalleled in the world. And if we clearly need to come up with technological innovations, and I'm not somebody who believes in, sort of like the technical fix is going to get us out of the climate emergency, but something along the lines of finding greater capacity for battery storage, bringing renewable energy systems online faster than they've been able to come on, and getting us off of fossil fuels. Look, where are those things going to be developed? We would be wise as a society to use these assets to develop them. And again, public policy and the public policy proposals that are being put forward in Congress by the progressives in Congress more or less fit with that kind of vision of a new industrial policy. And, you can look to a congressperson like Ro Khanna is very, very sharp and attuned to the necessity of basically supercharging the American university scientific research capacity to help achieve that. And that goes hand in hand with the kind of proposals we're putting forward too.
And I also want to say that, Americans have a limited knowledge of history, which I'm not going to blame them for that. Okay. I think our educational system fails them too often when it comes to teaching history, but it's not as if we've never done it before. The 1930s witnessed, without a question, in relative terms, a true revolution. I mean, it saw the empowerment of working people. It saw the creation of Social Security. It saw a dramatic, literally, revolution in the American landscape in terms of, by way of the Civilian Conservation Corps, 2 million young Americans who planted 3 billion trees, fought the Dust Bowl drought in the Midwest. Bridges were built, roads were laid, schools were built, libraries were built, post offices were built. I know I'm leaving out. Oh, massive arts programs, which unprecedented arts programs across the country. I mean, all of it was doable in the midst of the Great Depression. And it is astounding just how truly amnesia, it's like we're all suffering this mass amnesia to think that, oh, it seems so impossible. That's the striking thing. Right. I can tell you when I was working on my Fight for the Four Freedoms and then and all the talks I gave afterward, the most frustrating thing was that I thought people knew about so much of this stuff and I was just bringing it together. And it was people just didn't even realize. And in part because conservatives have done a damn good job of repressing memory and liberals have truly deferred to that because liberals are afraid of empowering their fellow citizens the way FDR was not afraid to do so, which is why progressives have got to understand the legislation is essential, but they've got to get out into the, call it the streets, call it wherever you, and start rallying Americans to realize the possibilities that present themselves. I mean, I think that's imperative.
Yeah. No, and just to finish up here, I think one of the things that I like so much about what you've done here, in addition to this, the kind of telling a coherent story, bringing everything together, showing the links between things, tying it to the specific, is also that so many people that I speak to feel very, very hopeless, very, very apocalyptic in their rhetoric. You hear a lot of people in my generation and among the Zoomers, right, talking like they're doomed, talking like the planet is fucked, everything's fucked, they're all disaffected completely, politics is hopeless. I think the failure of Bernie's two campaigns left a lot of people feeling like politics and also the kind of dirty tricks that were used to thwart him left a lot of people feeling like there was no hope in American politics. So what I like is the idea of something that can inspire people again post Bernie's two campaigns and can bring us together around something that is achievable and help us do what I think is the very, very urgent task right now, which is getting people to actually believe in something and move forward towards something, which is real hard at the moment, where Biden has put the whole country to sleep and nobody wants to pay attention to politics at all because it's all just so awful.
Yeah, it's a very difficult moment, and an organization like PDA, we're going to have to fight after the primary season for an effort to prevent the Republicans from winning one of the houses of Congress. It's actually easier in the Senate right now. It's going to be very difficult in the House. And it could be an avalanche in favor of the Republicans, not unlike 94. And it was in 2010, the last two times we had a Democrat elected in their first term. They suffered tremendous defeats at the midterm. Everything that I think Harvey and I, when we look out at this current cycle of elections, as I started out saying, nothing is surprising and everything is really confirming our perception. And it points to something you just said, Nathan. The way I would frame it is that, look, U.S. capital is dominant still in the world. How much so? There's a million ways we can point to the fact that, yes, the United States seems to be losing its sort of complete global hegemonic control. China, obviously, is more of a rival than maybe people expected it to be this quickly after the Cold War. But still, their U.S. capital and capital based in the United States, and the United States then is a tax haven effectively for all of the wealthy people around the world. Of course, all the wealthiest people own some kind of property in New York or Los Angeles or somewhere else. Then there's Silicon Valley. And again, a whole bunch of wealth exists in this country. And the people who control and own that are going to defend it. They're going to defend the structures that have allowed the wealth to reach astronomical sums. I mean, the kind of fortunes that the wealthiest people in the United States have, and in a political electoral system, which money can effectively buy and obviously sway elections, it's going to be a very, very difficult terrain. But we just have to continue to retrench and make the case. And we see in public opinion polls the popularity of it. I think we on the progressive left who are involved in electoral politics have to take what we learned from 2022. And I think we have to approach 2024 in light of what we've learned from 2022. And I certainly would argue, and part of this project is about a kind of unified progressive message built around the central concerns of the American public. And then to bring that into the electoral realm in as coherent and cohesive a way as possible and try to produce the best results. Now, I think the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights is basically appealing, as is the Green New Deal, as are so many of the other things that are focused upon as electoral issues on the progressive left. But we think this has been downplayed to a degree that is tragic for the results that we can achieve if we lift up our economic messaging. And when we do so, we take ourselves into the next round of elections, hopefully in a unified way. Maybe there'll be a presidential person, candidate who can carry the banner. Maybe they won't. But we have to just continue to recognize that we have to achieve things on the realm of public policy. Right. That's why the right wing and the rich are investing so much money. They understand that the organization of our society, markets, economic markets, their social contracts, their political constructs, and the people who control the politics and the public policy get to set the parameters of those things that influence everyone's life. We have to play in that field and we have to play to win. And I think an economic 21st century economic bill of rights is a powerful framing for us to go forward with. It hasn't been tried in any kind of mass effect yet. Hopefully we can lift it up, build momentum around it, make the case to all of our allies on the progressive left, and keep giving it a shot.
Nobody can be more anxious than I am right now about the upcoming elections. And I can only, and I know Alan and I are doing our damnedest, and I appreciate your having us on to get this message out and to remind people that as dark as it may seem or as gloomy as it may seem, there really are ideas and possibilities. And I would tell anyone that if they live, for example, if they lived in a district where they're represented by someone who might well belong to the Progressive Caucus, they really ought to get some people together and go make some noise and have that member of the Progressive Caucus take the Economic Bill of Rights into the caucus and start having a conversation there. In other words, it's going to take grassroots effort to get even the so-called progressives to start paying attention to these things. They, too, are dependent on money for re-election. They, too, are dependent on the Democratic Party machine. But they've got to feel some heat in favor of pursuing this progressive vision.
Harvey K., Alan Minsky, thank you so much for joining us on Current Affairs. People can read your article series explaining the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights at Common Dreams. And as Alan mentioned, it's also available on the Progressive Democrats website, Progressive Democrats of America website, which is pdaamerica.org/economic bill of rights. Thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nathan, very much. Thank you.